two penguins is a sign of just how quickly climate change is happening, particularly down there, because...
You are listening to the WGXC Acre 90.7 on your FM dial and WGXC.org on your smartphone or computer.
The Catskill Food Pantry is located in the Parish Hall of St. Luke's Episcopal Church at 50 William Street in Catskill. The pantry is open to the public every Friday from 1 to 4 p.m. Healthy food is a right. For more information, please feel welcome to visit the pantry, call us at 551-299-2456, check the website at catskillfoodpantry.org, or connect with us on Facebook at Catskill Food Pantry.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Greenville Drive-In 32, a destination for movies and music under the stars of the Northern Catskills since 1959. Seasonal programming information at drivein32.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Pat in Catskill, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, July the 5th, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. The Biden administration is proposing rules to protect workers from extreme heat. Our Eric Tegetoff has the story.
The Occupational Safety and Health Administration says its proposed regulations would protect 36 million workers in outdoor and indoor situations. Samantha Guerrero with the Idaho Organization of Resource Councils says these protections are needed for the state's farm workers.
This would require worker access to clean drinking water and for access to shaded or indoor rest areas. And this would also allow the right to take regular rest breaks, which in Idaho law, we currently don't have anything like that.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics says 479 workers died from heat exposure between 2011 and 2022, and there were more than 33,000 heat-related illnesses and injuries reported in that time. A poll from the Rural Democracy Initiative found these kinds of protections are popular, with 77% of rural voters supporting workers' right to organize for safe working conditions. Guerrero says it's important for the federal government to step up in the area to fill in gaps in Idaho laws.
There are a lot of farm workers who are in danger of losing their lives in these extreme temperatures, and so far we have seen no urgency from the state.
Advocates say farm workers are among the most affected by extreme heat, and yet they have the fewest safeguards. Next, from the New York Times, President Biden told a gathering of Democratic governors that he needs to get more sleep and work fewer hours, including curtailing events after 8 p.m. That's according to two people who participated in the meeting and several others briefed on his comments. The take from the New York Times is the remarks on Wednesday were a stark acknowledgement of fatigue from the 81-year-old president during a meeting intended to reassure more than two dozen of his most important supporters that he is still in command of the job and capable of mounting a robust campaign against former President Donald J. Trump. And New Mexicans impacted by recent wildfires and subsequent flooding may be eligible for disaster supplemental nutrition program benefits.
The additional SNAP dollars will provide 1 month of groceries for individuals and families affected by the South Fork and Salt fires. Meanwhile, state epidemiologist Srikanth Palagadu says those in wildfire-prone areas should always be prepared because the state's increased and persistent heat, as well as strong winds, can aggravate asthma and other respiratory issues in both children and adults.
For example, during the 2022 Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon fire, we reported a significant increase in the number of emergency room visits compared to what it was in the same time frame in 2021.
The 2022 fires were the largest in state history. I'm Roz Brown.
New Mexico has created a new 531 visibility tool, incorporating mileage and landmarks to help determine visibility if a wildfire is nearby and the need to seek shelter. This is Public News Service. Groups that advocate for people detained in immigration facilities are calling for the reinstatement of a program that allowed 500 free minutes of phone calls per month.
In recent weeks, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, cut off the free domestic and international calls, telling advocates that the pandemic-era funding has run out. Rosa Santana with Envision Freedom Fund says families of the detainees often struggle to afford the calls, which can cost up to $3 for 15 minutes.
Usually the person who is in detention is the breadwinner, and now families have to be able to figure out how they could bring food and everything that the breadwinner used to bring, pay rent, and on top of that now is like having to pay for phone calls.
ICE did not respond to a request for comment. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Meantime, Alabama's universities and community colleges will receive increased funding for 2025.
The state's universities are set to get a 7% boost that's equivalent to about $100 million. Jim Purcell is the executive director of the Alabama Commission on Higher Education. During a quarterly meeting, he expressed satisfaction with the outcome in the state legislature. He says it came close to achieving its funding target.
You know, we had made budget recommendations. They were relatively close, but as you know, some people have better politics than others, so it's not exact science.
The commission also saw budget increases that bolstered the state's student assistance program and allocated additional funds to aid in FAFSA completion for prospective college students. Shantia Hudson reporting.
The national average for need-based aid allocation is about 10%. Finally, from our Edwin J. Vieira, almost 200,000 acres of New York have been protected by the Conservation Fund.
This comes as the group which protects wilderness working in natural spaces announced it's protected more than 1 million acres of at-risk forest land. Studies show 13 million acres of forest land nationwide will be at risk in the coming decades due to many factors. Tom Duffus with the Conservation Fund says forests are a major answer to climate change.
It's a defense mechanism against the storms that happen with climate change, but also the benefits of the carbon are a huge issue for conserving large-scale forest land.
But this work has been more of a rescue mission. Duffus says the group competes in a marketplace with timber investors and real estate developers for this land with a high success rate. By 2035, the group aims to protect 5 million acres of U.S. forests.
Conserving forest land is important for New York to achieve its goal of conserving 30% of the state's lands and waters by 2030. More than $1 million is available through the state's Forest Conservation Easements for Land Trusts grant program. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, heard on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform, and find our content and trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Are you at risk of losing your home to a wildfire? Independent research in a new map shows who's in danger, an important tool for under-resourced communities.
In many rural places, there may not be as much staffing and resources to mitigate the risk.
Kelly Pohl with Headwaters Economics helped update a six-year-old map from the U.S. Forest Service. She says the map shows counties and tribal areas in the most danger nationwide.
What we're seeing is really widespread wildfire risk across the country. This is certainly not just a Western issue. There are a lot of states, especially in the Southeast, that have wildfire risk.
Pohl says a new map incorporates the latest vegetation and climate data, home and building construction, and wildfire simulations. Rural communities have long worried about wildfires and the staffing for fighting them, but the Biden administration has new grant programs to better equip communities for fire resilience. Folks in substance abuse recovery need a safe place to sleep. That's one reason rural groups are promoting supportive and affordable housing. Molly Egan has more.
Luke Lauterbilk found it hard to get clean on his own. After moving into a day one recovery center in North Carolina, he's convinced housing and community are key.
I tried to get clean several times, but it never clicked. It's not until I came here that I realized that this is a WE program. I can't recover by myself.
In rural areas where services can be limited, recovery houses provide a bundle of aid. Corey Richardson is with Integrated Care of Greater Hickory, North Carolina.
We incorporate housing, peer support, transportation, med management. It's a real wraparound program.
With case-by-case care, Richardson says the housing projects offer personalized roads to recovery. I'm Molly Egan.
Libraries are rolling across rural California this summer. Save the Children is sending bookmobiles out to combat learning loss over the summer break. Lucero Chavez Ramirez says their Make Summer Fair program is about boosting learning in out-of-the-way neighborhoods.
Especially for children in these rural underserved areas where they might not have the opportunity to participate in other activities.
Kids can lose 2 months learning while out of school, with math and spelling skills slipping the most. Along with mobile libraries, parents and caregivers can be the best teachers. Save the Children's Yolanda Miner says kids can learn even through simple problem solving while cooking dinner.
When you're preparing a recipe, talk about the measuring of the ingredients, the measuring cups, how many scoops. So many things that you can do at dinner time.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm well-meaning, and I'm an elderly man, and I know what the hell I'm doing. I've been president, and I put this country back on its feet.
President Joe Biden defended his abilities after comments from special counsel Robert Hur questioned how the president might appear. Biden met with Democrats in Congress and in governor's offices Wednesday, later telling campaign staffers he's not leaving the race. He'll campaign in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania this weekend and will sit for a lengthy interview with ABC, his first since a highly criticized debate performance. Polls show some erosion for Biden, but still call the election a toss-up. Backers of an Ohio constitutional amendment to end gerrymandering say they have 700,000 signatures to get on the state's ballot this fall. Barbara Hunsicker with the League of Women Voters tells WKYC it would take map-drawing power from a state redistricting commission and return it to ordinary people.
This truly is a citizen initiative, citizen-supported, and we are looking forward to real reform with teeth.
Since 2020, legal challenges have resulted in 2 Ohio congressional maps and 5 statehouse maps being rejected as unconstitutional. The Pennsylvania Senate has advanced a bill to block state funding for any college that divests from Israel. Democratic State Senator Steve Santarsario says that doesn't impact free speech by students or staff.
They'd still be free to protest and assemble peacefully under the First Amendment, but if the schools took that step, there would be a consequence.
Supporters say the bill addresses a rise in anti-Semitism following pro-Palestinian encampments at the University of Pennsylvania and Drexel. 5 states have certified abortion rights ballot measures for November, with more pending. In Arkansas, supporters of legalizing the procedure through 20 weeks say they're just shy of the signatures needed. Jenny Diaz with 4 Arkansas People says hundreds of doctors and nurses have signed on.
Providers' hands are really tied when it comes to providing routine emergency health care for women, and we want to unburden them so that they can fully care for patients in the best way possible.
In Wisconsin, the liberal-led state Supreme Court says it will consider 2 challenges to a 175-year-old abortion ban reactivated when Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. Unions representing thousands of Philadelphia city employees have asked a judge to block Mayor Sherrell Parker's requirement that they return to their offices full-time next week. The union says it violates their contract and will make post-pandemic staffing shortages worse. But Parker says city government must be accessible.
I really do look forward to the day when Philadelphia government and all of its agencies are a government that our residents can see, touch, and feel.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Almost 200,000 acres of New York has been protected by the Conservation Fund. This comes as the group which protects wilderness working in natural spaces announced it's protected more than 1 million acres of at-risk forest land. Studies show 13 million acres of forest land nationwide will be at risk in the coming decades due to many factors. Tom Duffus with the Conservation Fund says forests are a major answer to climate change.
It's a defense mechanism against the storms that happen with climate change, but also the benefits of the carbon are a huge issue for conserving large-scale forest land.
But this work has been more of a rescue mission. Duffus says the group competes in a marketplace with timber investors and real estate developers for this land with a high success rate. By 2035, the group aims to protect 5 million acres of U.S. forests. After purchasing these lands, the group works out the best long-term conservation solution for it. This could mean state forest lands in New York or large conservation easements in Maine. Duffus says the group has one of the first forest carbon banks in the Pacific Northwest.
So that is an experiment where we are restoring redwoods and spotted owls and forest condition back to what nature really intended, using a working forest scenario where we are trying to manage the land to return it and restore it to the conditions that nature otherwise would have created.
Conserving forest land is important for New York to achieve its goal of conserving 30% of the state's lands and waters by 2030. More than $1 million is available through the state's Forest Conservation Easements for Land Trusts grant program. Accredited land trusts can apply for up to $350,000 to purchase conservation easements on forests to protect them. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello and welcome to the Better Weather for Friday, July 5th. Local early morning temperatures range from 66 degrees in Tannersville to 72 in Kinderhook. Air quality will be moderate, and that is hampered today by the dew point, which will reach an oppressive 75 degrees. Sensitive people will do best in front of an air conditioner. Chances for rain arrive in the area a little after noon. At 3 p.m., we hit our high temperature of 84 degrees. A chance of rain will linger all night long. We see a low temperature of 72 degrees kiss the dew point around sunup on Saturday. Chances for rain linger all day long, getting stronger in the afternoon. If you're planning to be outside at all this weekend, bring extra water. You are going to be sweating it out. 70 sticky degrees overnight takes us into a dry-looking Sunday. High temperature of 87 at 4 p.m. Dew points in the 70s will be keeping things pretty gross. Monday, still rain-free all day, but also still humid. High temperature of 88. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 2:55 a.m., low tide at 9:53 a.m., high tide again at 3:29 p.m., then low tide once again at 9:47 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 66 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 8:20 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:22 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 5%. Plasma winds will be slow at 368 kilometers per second with a thin density of 2 protons per cubic centimeter. Should be a calm weekend, magnetically speaking, anyway. Radio propagation conditions are currently pretty bad and really not getting much better overnight, so good luck. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 113. And this has been the Better Weather for Friday, July 5th, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice of choice, the world's only 12-hour strong man on the air, here on We Love Radio.
Next, we hear from Natural Information Society with Evan Parker guesting on the song Dissension Out of Our Constrictions, a 2021 album from the Aramite label on the radio at 90.7 FM. That was Natural Information Society with the 2021 song Dissension Out of Our Constrictions on WGXC.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Given the heat that we've been having in the Capital Region of late, some of you may be heading out to the beach. And Lori Dreyer, the head of the Lansingburg branch of Troy Public Library, is here to give you some suggestions of easy reads to stick in your tote bag for the beach. Lori, welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you, Bria. It's so nice to be here. And easy is right. I have to say, if you don't know what a beach read is, I can tell you, according to the website Black Girl Nerds, a good beach read leaves you feeling content and not too heartbroken over a character's plight, which I thought was a great way of putting it.
Black Girl Nerds. I love the name of the site.
Yes, that is where I got a lot of these suggestions, although not all of them. And these are all things that are at the library right now that you can come in and borrow immediately.
Terrific. So let's get started. What's the first one?
Well, the first one is called Summer on the Bluffs by Sunny Hostin. She is a co-host on The View, so a lot of your listeners may know who she is. I will read a little summary. Welcome to Oak Bluffs. The picturesque town on Martha's Vineyard is a mecca for the creme de la creme of Black society. Black people have lived in this pretty slip of the vineyard since the 1600s and began buying property in the 1800s, making this posh town the embodiment of old money. See, I already learned something. I didn't even know this. But this summer on the Bluffs is a little different. Amma is moving to the south of France to reunite with her college sweetheart. She is going to give her beautiful beach house to one of her goddaughters, and she has invited all three of them to spend the summer with her the way that they did when they were kids. Each of these women wants the house desperately, but each is also grappling with a secret that they fear will make them lose Amma's approval and the house. So this is the first in a series. So far, Hostin has only written the first two in the series, though I suspect she has more on the way. The second book in the series is called Summer in Sag Harbor. And it sounds just like the kind of perfect beach read. You know, you can sit and just kind of read it and not worry too much about the characters.
So it's a beach read set on a beach.
Precisely. That's the best kind. So the second one is by Jasmine Guillory. So some of your listeners may know Jasmine Guillory from her The Wedding Proposal. No, I'm sorry. It was just called The Proposal, which was a really popular book a couple years ago. This one that I'm recommending today is called Drunk on Love. Margot Noble needs some relief from the stress of running the family winery with her brother. Enter Luke. Sexy, charming, and best of all, in the too small world of Napa Valley, a stranger. The chemistry between them is undeniable, and Margot is delighted that she lucked into the perfect one-night stand she'll never have to see again. That is, until the winery's newest hire, Luke, walks in the next morning. Margot is determined to keep things purely professional. So you have to read the rest to see what happens. And this one has such a lovely, beautiful cover, too. It's very striking, orange and red, explosion looking. So that one's, I'm very much looking forward to reading that. I really enjoyed The Proposal.
And the name again is Drunk on Love by Jasmine Guillory, Guillory. Somehow the Remington Steele episode set in a winery where they found a body in one of the big vats came to mind. I take it there's no bodies in a vat in this.
I don't think so. But you'll have to read it to find out.
Okay, so Summer on the Bluffs, Drunk on Love, and the third one?
The third one is called Honey and Spice by Bolu Babalola. Sharp-tongued Kiki Banjo has just made a huge mistake. As an expert in relationship evasion and the host of the popular student radio show Brown Sugar, she's made it her mission to make sure that the women of Whitewell University do not fall into the mess of situationships, players, and heartbreak. But, of course, when Kiki kisses Malachi Coridi, the guy she just publicly denounced as the waste man of Whitewell in front of every Blackwellian on campus, she finds her show at risk. Kiki and Malachi are soon embroiled in a fake relationship to try and salvage both of their reputations and save their futures. Kiki has never surrendered to her heart before, and a player like Malachi won't be the one to change that, no matter how charming he is or how electric their connection feels. So,
that's a fun one.
And that's Honey and Spice by Bolu Babalola, B-A-B-A-L-O-L-A. And?
And the last one sounds so fun to me. It's called The Accidental Pinup by Danielle Jackson. And I have to say, the cover of this one is also just really great. It's a woman sitting on a chair, holding a camera, just looking very, very sassy. And I mean, how can you not want to read a book like that? So the book is about Cassie Harris. She loves being a professional photographer and owning her own photography business. Her best friend Dana is about to launch her own dreamy lingerie line, and she wants Cassie to shoot and direct the national campaign. So a pretty big deal. But company politics and Dana's pregnancy interfere, and Cassie finds herself not behind the camera, but in front of it. Though she's never modeled herself, Cassie is pretty confident in her ability to show off lingerie. What she's not sure of, though, is whether she can work so intimately with the chosen photographer, who happens to be her longtime competitor in the Chicago photography scene, Reed Montgomery. Of course, it turns out that their chemistry is undeniable on set, and feelings can develop faster than film.
Film, what's that?
Right? Oh, but it sounds so fun.
Okay, and that's The Accidental Pinup by Danielle Jackson. Those are the four beach reads, and I see you have another book for us. Not quite a beach read?
It is a beach read. I found it to be a really fun and quick and easy read. I mean, fun isn't the right word, but it was a provocative read. It's called When No One Is Watching. It is by Alyssa Cole, and some of your listeners may know Cole's name because she's a well-known romance writer. This book, however, is a step outside of that. This is a thriller. And this is about a woman named Sydney Green who has lived in Brooklyn. She was born and raised in Brooklyn in this one neighborhood. And the neighborhood she's noticed has started to change a lot. And so she's, you know, she's got new neighbors coming in. She makes a connection with one of her neighbors called Theo. And together, her and Theo figure out what's going on in their neighborhood. Why is it changing so significantly? Because these aren't just minor changes. These are like people disappearing changes. Yes. Dun, dun, dun.
People disappearing. Ooh. Okay. And that is When No One Is Watching by Alyssa Cole, C-O-L-E. Great. And while we're here at the library, maybe you can give us an update on what's happening with the renovations. Downstairs, it used to be open where you could see that everything was being torn apart in what had been the children's room. And now there's a beautiful temporary wall with a mural on it. But I suspect there's a lot of work going on behind that mural.
There is indeed. And some of it's not happening exactly in that room, but it is happening around that room. First of all, the mural was just recently completed by Emma Rinaldi, a well-known painter in the area who does pet portraits, and they're just lovely. One of my employees got one of his cat. It was amazing. And so we were really lucky for her to come in and do this mural. The mural is not, I will warn you, it is not of a cat. There are no cats in the mural, but it is really lovely. And so I recommend everybody come down and take a look at it. As far as the renovations, getting the room back up and running, we are working on that. We are currently writing some grants and looking for outside monies to try and get the room revamped and put back to rights.
So if you're still in the fundraising stage, it's not going to be for a little while.
Unfortunately, no. This summer, we've definitely decided that the room will remain closed, which, of course, impacts our programming space. So our summer reading program is a little bit smaller than it generally is. But soon, soon. It will be back if I have anything to say about it, I assure you.
Okay, thanks again. And that's Lori Dreyer, the manager of the Lansingburg branch of the Troy Public Library, and it is located at
27 114th Street, and we are just down the street from Snowman Ice Cream. So come get an ice cream and visit the library.
Or maybe switch that order so you're not dripping ice cream on everything. Thank you so much, Lori. It's great to see you again.
Oh, thank you, Bray. It's so good to see you, too.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
La Despensa de Alimentos de Catskill está localizada en la Parroquia de la Iglesia de St. Luke en Catskill, en la calle William, número 50. La despensa está abierta todos los viernes de la 1 hasta las 4 de la tarde. La comida sana es un derecho. Para más información, bienvenidos a todos a venir. Llamar por teléfono a 551-299-2456. Mirar la página web catskillfoodpantry.org o conectar con nosotros en Facebook en Catskill Food Pantry.
Hi, I'm Jean Thomas.
And I'm Tim Kenalty.
Welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We're talking again today to Christopher Williams, PRISM Coordinator for the Capital Region PRISM. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you for having me today.
So can you remind us what the acronym PRISM stands for and generally what your group does?
Hi, I'm Chris Williams from the Capital Region PRISM, a partnership for regional invasive species management. We're one of 8 PRISMs in the state that are funded by the New York State DEC, and each PRISM has a different host. Thank you for having me today.
And again, PRISM stands for?
Partnership for Regional Invasive Species Management.
It's a test that we always do when you come by, right?
Yeah.
Make sure you remember the acronym. So you, one of the great things you do, and I know we were beneficiaries at the Land Conservancy, is you manage a lot of grants, and you do a lot of grant work with a lot of your partner organizations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. We have a host of deliverables that we fulfill for the New York State DEC. Education and outreach, early detection and rapid response, but we also coordinate efforts with our partners. And one of the ways we do that is we offer a request for proposals. Typically in December of each year, we will make an announcement that our funding window for applications is open, and we will have people apply for funds. Our requests for proposals are up to $25,000, and the purpose of them is to help assist partners with managing invasive species with projects that are tied to our annual work plan. And there is a host of proposals that have been completed over the last 5 years, and there's quite the range. But it's an opportunity for people to seek funding that doesn't require a match, and we are directly funded from the Environmental Protection Fund through the state. It needs to be aligned to our work plan that has justifications for the work that's being done.
And tell us about a really cool example of one that has recently got a grant that you're excited about.
Yes. We have a new partnership with the Grasslands Bird Trust in Fort Edward, New York. Washington County, New York has a bird wildlife management area. It's about an 18,000 acre parcel.
Wow.
And there are state lands there. And surrounding the outside of that are private preserves for those rare and endangered or species of concerns like the short-eared owl, the snowy owl. But the Bird Grassland Trust sought us out, and we had several meetings with some of their staff about how to prioritize and control invasives in some of the grasslands. They had noted that their bird counts were down. And it's hard to prove why a bird count is down, except for in this case, where the invasives are, the bird counts were down, and the parcels right next to it where the native sedges and grasses were, the bird counts were fine.
Huh.
So there was quite a strong correlation there. And they have a research proposal, but we're setting up research grids where they're going to do some selective herbicide treatment to get rid of thistles and knapweed.
Our favorites. Yeah.
And then there's some other treatments that they're going to do to get rid of reed canary grass. At the same time, post-treatment follow-up will be letting the native seed bank take over and then introducing new seed bank as a restoration project. And so there's some small parcels being set up, so how these treatments will work. There's a lot of interest in this project because there are, this knapweed is a threat to the actual state lands. And so the partnership for this, it's quite involved. There are state biologists involved. There's the PRISM and then the Grassland Trust people. And so we're working together to initiate this pilot project. And I'm really excited.
It sounds very cool.
Yeah. And everybody's on board. You know, so it's kind of like a win-win. Let's do this. There's a good volunteer base. So that's an example of a project. And we're funding all the equipment supplies. We've brought in consultants from Cornell to actually help with making decisions and how to set up like these parcels for studying. So there's quite an army of people involved in this little project.
So last time you were here, I think we asked you how you didn't get depressed, and I now understand how you're not depressed, because things like this give you a little hope, right?
Yeah, so we're actually applying science that's prescriptive in nature, and there's an outcome that we're expecting.
Very cool.
How many acres is it again?
The Grassland Bird Trust has two parcels that are around 80 acres, but it's part of a bigger complex for an ecological connectivity. The Fort Edward Grasslands, it's called, in Washington County, is around 18,000 acres that have been identified as critical habitat for certain species.
That's awesome. The difference you can make will be phenomenal.
Yeah, it's just a small project.
Great. Okay, last time you were here, we talked about invasive terrestrial plants and some aquatic. We're going to turn today to invasive animals and pathogens. Now, I notice that you have some of our arch enemies listed as tier 3 and 4, like jumping worms and emerald ash borer, Japanese beetles, hemlock woolly adelgid, and marmorated stink bugs, my favorite.
Ugh.
Does that mean we've already lost the battle to these pests? They have been here an awfully long time.
I would say no, we have not lost the battle. I would say that there are some species that have in certain specific cases. So I'd like to take a look at these as individuals and look at them individually and not holistically. Obviously, the emerald ash borer, that creature is fast moving. And so its spread throughout New York was rather quick. And it's unfortunate that we have the loss of the ash trees throughout New York. And I do see the damage. When I drive, I have family in Buffalo. I live in the Capital Region. When I do the drive, I see thousands and thousands of dead ash trees. So that's an unfortunate case. Learning lessons from that species and the transportation of firewood, which should not be done. We shouldn't be moving firewood around. There are measures that we can do in the future to help curb these infestations. Then on another scale, some of these other pestilents, like hemlock woolly adelgid, they don't move as fast, and the cold winters keep them at bay somewhat to buy time for biocontrol release. So, yeah, I like to look at all these forest pests and pathogens as what can we learn from them, and how can we use that information to hopefully do a better job in the future.
So where are we with emerald ash borer? I mean, I know I've lost hundreds on my property. Are we finding disease-resistant trees? Like, is there some hope for the future of the ash trees?
I would say yes, there's hope for the future. And why I would like to say that is I know that there's a couple programs out there where they are looking for some ash trees are resistant to the ash borer. I've read that, and I took a program once. It's like 1 in 1,000. So if you have like an ash stand and you know it got struck hard by the emerald ash borer, but there's a tree that didn't, that's worth maybe reporting. From a scientific perspective, it's nice to have a plot set up first and really monitor the mortality over time. So I know that there's somebody in-state that's doing a project for that, a private group. And then I also know the federal government has been involved with basically collecting scions, branches mm-hmm. of the trees, and grafting them. So there's a program in place that could see the return of the ash tree. I just don't know if it'll be a cultivar or a hybrid. But I think that would take a really long time to have a tree that's resistant and then to reintroduce it to our it's going to take probably a lifetime.
It's like the disease-resistant elms that are just starting to come out,
yeah,
right?
And the chestnuts.
Yeah.
And it does. It takes decades and decades of research. But it's nice to know that we live in a period of time where these practices can be put in place to help preserve for future release again. So I think it's great. On the other hand, is the emerald ash borer, the federal quarantine was lifted. They recognize that there's nothing they can do, and it's running its course, unfortunately, right now. I do recommend to landowners two things. If they have an ash stand, with really good ash trees that are saw timber grade that could be harvested. There's economic value there, and they could seek out a harvest. And I always tell them, just turn around and use the funds to replant a new forest mm-hmm. for regeneration. The other part is, if your ash trees have been hit by the emerald ash borer, they're very dangerous to fell those trees. The interior of the tree, you know, the rot is not uniform throughout the tree. And when you fell a tree that's an ash tree that's dead, it doesn't fall like it would normally yeah. do. So they're a human health hazard after the fact. So that's why I kind of encourage people to remove their ash trees for a harvest before they get struck. But on the backside, not every homeowner has emerald ash borer. So again, don't be spreading and moving your infected trees around, because then you're just, you know, you might be causing an economic loss or a damage to a town or a park, a preserve, or a private landowner by inadvertently spreading it.
And if they're in a place that it's not danger to people, isn't it true that you'd want to leave some of the snags for wildlife as well?
Yeah, that is another recommendation, and that's one I do give. Like, you know, some of those birds will like those hollowed out trees for a habitat, but it might be with caution with saying that, because again, you get a windstorm and you're walking around in right. an ash stand of dead trees, that could be hazardous. So I got to throw that in there.
Right, know. Absolutely.
Dead trees, those widow makers are not good.
Okay. Hemlocks. I adore hemlocks. They have such a wonderful history. And now these stinky, nasty, woolly adelgids are going on. What's the future with that?
I live in a place where the hemlock stands are 68% of the trees on the Adirondack Blue Line. The New York State Hemlock Initiative, led by Mark Whitmore, they have a biocontrol program. One of our partnerships with them through the New York State DEC is to identify infestations on the leading edge before it gets into the Adirondack Park, which we now know it is, but to encourage private and public landowners to do treatments on that leading edge. On the backside is releasing biocontrols to do studies to see if they're taking. So we're trying to buy time through managing identification and management. But it's hard over a large scale. There's a lot of parcels that are being taken care of, then there's some that's not. And the adelgid isn't found everywhere. You can go down to, like, you know, it's been in New York since 1980. You can go in the lower Hudson, you can go down around Ithaca and the southern tier, and you'll have dead hemlock stands. And then you can go just down the road and there's a thriving hemlock stand. So it's intermittent. It's not found everywhere. And there is mortality with really cold winters, except for the punctuated equilibrium problem, where the ones that did survive may be more cold tolerant. So
wait a minute, punctuated equilibrium.
I like that. That's one we've never heard.
I gotta write that down.
Yeah,
I think that's a biological term I learned back in college. That sometimes there's responses in the environment, and you know, organisms adapt really quickly, and then have offspring that adjust to it. Think of a fruit fly. Think of these smaller, you know, high rates of reproductivity.
Yeah. Right.
I'm not an expert in that field, but it's a cool word.
So there are some biocontrols for hemlock woolly adelgid that are out there now?
There are. The Hemlock Initiative, which is also funded through the state, through the New York State DEC. Mark Whitmore has done a good job. First, the adelgid that's been let loose here in New York is probably from Christmas tree stock that's been transported. Mm. And the species is native to Japan. So there is a natural predator in Japan that's been introduced. They call it Little Larry. It's a beetle. But it eats one of the generations of HWA. So there's two generations a year for mm-hmm. HWA, and it is eating one of them. Now, it's not active when the adelgid has its second offspring are born. So there's a need for another predator. Yeah. And so Mark Whitmore